From RTE Radio, I'm Niall O'Sheridan. This is Playback Daily.
Makes everything better, even music acoustically. Just a change up of scenery can make such a difference in the trees all around it. So even on the worst day, you can be out there nice and cosy.
Is there anyone over there from Dancing with the Stars with the Command Live Line?
Love the 20s. 20s is great. So in the 20s, you've got the bob, which is a radical change. So suddenly everyone's cutting their hair short. And again, a very democratic hairstyle.
Coming up on this first day of midterm edition of Playback Daily, the benefits of an outdoor education, a controversial exit from Dancing with the Stars, and tracing the history of Dublin through women's hairstyles. That's all on the way over the next hour of the radio catch-up show that every day is a bad hair day for. Morning time is usually monologue time on Oliver Callan, and this morning was no exception. Our host caught up on the weekend award ceremonies, beginning with the IFTAs, and how last week's guest, actor Brian F. O'Byrne, fared.
Nominated for his role as the Monsignor in Conclave, and he won it. So he has that rather pretty Celtic woman statue to add to his BAFTA and his Tony Awards back home in West Sligo. So he's now a BIFTA. Is there an EGOT for those ones? A BIFTA, one of the few to have won both the BAFTAs, a BAFTA and an IFTA. And by the way, the IFTAs as an awards show really thriving in recent years, especially because it looked at one point like it was in trouble. There was a period when it was no longer televised. They kind of had invented categories to get one big star to attend every year. It hopped about on the calendar. They separated telly from the film and all that. But now, since the Irish talent is doing so well in the film and television industry around the world and so many productions are being made here, the IFTAs has finally become an award that serious people have wanted to win now for the last couple of years, and an event that the big stars want to attend, and they did in great numbers, and you would have seen the coverage over the weekend. Kevin McGarren, by the way, did a very sharp turn as the awards host, and some good barbs in there. Some of them too spicy for morning radio, as we said. That's a good sign. And finally, they got a comedian to do it. It's the way to go, like the rest of the ones do it. Nick Capron won a rake of awards there, but they didn't do as well as expected at the BAFTAs, which were in London last night, because they were up for 6 awards. They did get an award for the director who got his Irish citizenship. He's an English fella who moved to Belfast and saw this kneecap cultural phenomenon needs to be a movie, and it is. And it was interesting because it kind of brings an end to their over a year long trip now in the film industry, because they started out in Sundance in January last year, and absolutely massive hit film. And they announced they're not going to do another film, they're going to concentrate on the music. But they have won BAFTA for that film, but it was a bit, even The Guardian this morning is saying it was a bit of a snub to lose out on the best film not in the English language, which went to Emilia Perez, the much derided musical drama on Netflix, which has gone through as an award season from hell. Much admired kneecap was left out, they said, of the whole thing. But there you go. And speaking of the BAFTAs, there were a number of surprises there, because Conclave, which we're now obsessed with in this programme, although it is the one kind of popular film, most watched movie that's in the award season. The rest of them are quite indie and most people won't ever bother watching them, let's face it. Conclave won quite a few awards, won 4 awards, including the best film. But somehow they didn't give the Best Actor award to Ralph Fiennes. And they're saying that is a huge snub, particularly because it's in his own backyard. You'd imagine he'd be honoured in London. And he hasn't won a BAFTA now since Best Supporting Actor in Schindler's List, which is 30 years ago, and 6 nominations in a row he's gone through without a win. Probably because he doesn't campaign. You have to campaign for these things. He's not into the celebrity thing, Ralph Fiennes. And there was also a big snub for the Bob Dylan film, another popular film actually people would have seen. A Complete Unknown went home completely empty-handed, was what happened to them. And the other surprise is Demi Moore was expected to win Best Actress, but she lost to Mikey Madison, who's in Anora, which I saw actually in the streamer, is the biggest film at the moment streaming, so people are watching that. It's kind of a mad romantic drama, which is like first half of the film is all sweetness and light, and the second half of the film is a really funny episode of the Sopranos. It's really good. Had a puzzling ending, but it was really good. It's quite grim, and she is amazing, fantastic in it. The substance is just completely, not many people are going to watch that. You want to really be into your horror to watch that. There are the surprises.
Just to offer a slight counterpoint, The Substance was really good. Icky as opposed to scary, and Demi Moore was fantastic. Mikey Madison was terrific in Anora also. No argument there. But Emilia Perez was great and odd and deserves, I think, a bit more than to be dismissed. Likely down to the problematic behaviour of its star, since she was nominated for Best Actress. But look, all three movies are good movies. It's editorial of me, I know, but I wanted to give both The Substance and Emilia Perez Cochrane the Fania. You know? Anyway, back to Oliver's coverage of the BAFTAs.
Jesse Eisenberg went up three times to the podium at the BAFTAs last night, and it's quite interesting because he is he's the writer, director and supporting actor of this film, A Real Pain, which, what is it about again? Mismatched cousins who reunite for a Jewish heritage tour through Poland in honour of their late granny, but old tensions resurface against the backdrop. And this is the one that Kieran Culkin is set to win. He's almost certain now to win the Oscar because he's won five acting awards in a row and he hasn't been there to accept any of them. And Jesse Eisenberg has gone up. He's best known, I think, for A Social Network. He replaced the Zuckerberg character in that way back in 2010. And so Kieran Culkin is absent from the award season at the moment. Why is that? Because he is looking after a family member in New York who's quite sick. And Jesse Eisenberg said he's so devoted as a dad, he tried to opt out of this film 2 weeks before we started shooting because he didn't want to leave the kids. And it's admirable, his devotion to his family. And that's why he's missed the Golden Globes, Critics' Choice Awards, two other ceremonies, plus the BAFTAs last night. Jesse Eisenberg also won Best Original Screenplay, and he gave an emotional speech on stage, and it was mostly to do with his wife. But he was also referencing the fact that he was sitting very, very far from the stage and took a while to get up to the podium, and explaining why he was kind of not very prepared for this moment.
I didn't write anything because I didn't think I'd win, and I do want to share this with my wife, who didn't come because she didn't think I'd win. I think the person who sat me didn't think I'd win. Anyway, I want to share this with my wife because I'm not a stupid person, but I'm an idiot. And when we first started dating, she dragged me to Venezuela to backpack through Venezuela. And since then, over the last 20 something years, she's dragged me around the world reluctantly. And it's the way I got to know about the world, which is what this movie's about. And you know, she also, through strict Marxist Leninist principles, taught me that my grief is unexceptionable compared to the rest of the world, which is the other thing this movie is about. So, Anna, you put every worthwhile thought into my head over the last 20 years, and I love you so much.
Jesse Eisenberg there reminded me, that's why Daniel Day-Lewis didn't do interviews, because you know he just plays himself. He plays himself in all his movies, that's for sure. Ring the Irish Interest Bell. He mentioned his wife, Anna Strout is her name, and they've been married since 2017. Jesse Eisenberg made a film here in Ireland called Vivarium just about 5 or 6 years ago, and it was about the housing crisis in Ireland. Lorcan Finnegan was the guy who wrote it, and Aina Hardwick was in it, if my memory serves me right. And he says his wife has a particular interest in Ireland, and she helped produce various events, including one which was about political protests in the country. It was hosted by Stephen Ray, and she went all around the country, he says in the interview, promoting Vivarium. And And my wife's brother wrote the book The People Speak Ireland. So she'd seen everything, is in the studio, and he wants to come back here because she's obsessed with the place.
Obsessed Marxist-Leninist seeks return to Ireland for work purposes. Don't know about that. Pivot! The whole 21st century thing about having a housing crisis is not unique to Ireland, Oliver tells us.
Australia, who want to put a 2-year ban on foreigners buying existing homes amid the housing crunch. Is there a country in the world that doesn't seem to have a housing crisis? Because one of the reasons Justin Trudeau stepped down is because of his plummeting opinion polls, because of a housing crisis in Canada, mostly to do with just the enormous rising cost of rent. Similar reasons to Ireland, we just selling properties to massive multinational firms that can then set the price of rent in your chosen city. So what are they going to do? They're going to ban foreigners from buying existing homes for the next 2 years in an effort to boost under pressure housing supply. And that's coming in. Dissatisfaction with housing in Australia has reached an all-time high, and it's an issue that's expected to dominate a general election happening in May. There's always an election when these things are being announced. It's the largest contributor to the rising cost of living in Australia is set to be the key issue. A poll had the centre-left Labour government there lagging its main conservative political opposition. And that's what's happening in that country. That will be a similar ban to the one that's in New Zealand. They put that in place in 2018. Spain, famously in the last month, proposed laws to ban non-EU nationals from buying homes, which would hit the Brits very hard. Austria already has restrictions on non-EU citizens buying homes. You have to be a resident in Vienna before you buy anything there. The Swiss, of course, not in the EU, but they have a quota on the number of holiday homes they sell each year to anyone who's not a resident of Switzerland. I think only 1,000 holiday homes a year maximum they can sell to non-Swiss people. And, you know, that's unlikely to happen in Ireland given our multinational focus in this country. But anecdotally, at least, we're hearing a lot of evidence that American investors, very wealthy people, are snapping up the high net worth mansions. 1,200 homes priced over 1 million euro were sold in Ireland last year. And they're particularly interested, you know, there was one obviously for 30 million, a big estate outside Yall. But Kinsale as well. There were three houses in Kinsale. One was 3 million, another was 5 million, 5.5 million. And anecdotally, at least, we're hearing the big Americans who are concerned about wildfires and climate change in America are buying those big, big mansions in the kind of high net worth areas. And that brings us to the Irish story. It's in the today's Indo. A fresh bid to crack down on Airbnb to lift the housing stock level. This feels like a conversation that's been going on for years. A fresh effort to crack down on Airbnbs and short-term rentals is to be one of the new government's first moves towards improving the housing stock. And this is proposed new laws targeting short-term lets. What are they doing? They're doing something which I thought was in place. Plans for clampdown were signed off by the last government in December 2022, but stalled time and time again, and they blamed them on EU rules. And under new proposed laws, landlords who use properties for short-term lets will have to register them or face being fined up to 5,000 euro, which is exactly the same thing that they proposed back in 2018. And they also, which is not being mentioned this time, they propose a maximum use of 90 days for short-term lets to just let you do let it out for the summer, basically. Short-term letting websites will be fined up to 5,000 euro if they don't remove the adverts or properties that are not listed. And there were some restrictions brought in 2019, but it leads to the local councils to enforce them. And there is a lot of claim from the opposition that that wasn't happening, basically.
Ah, the joys of living in Ireland and the way she might look at you. That's Oliver Callan with his monologue from this morning. One of the fallouts from the pandemic is that primary schools around the country are now developing outdoor classrooms. In our climate, you ask? Apparently so, because outdoor learning has benefits for all sorts of children's educational and social development. On This Morning's Today with Claire Byrne, Philip Boucher-Hayes, sitting in for Claire, heard from reporter Maura Fay, who visited one school leading the field in outdoor education.
What exactly is outdoor education?
Well, Philip, at its most basic level, outdoor education is any learning that takes place outside. We know in this era of climate change, there's huge emphasis on learning about things like the environment, sustainability and nature. Interestingly, a report last year by the social enterprise organisation Biodiversity in Schools found that 46% of teachers no longer have nature tables in their classroom.
Really?
Yeah.
I thought it was a staple of every classroom, but go on.
Well, I visited Carlow Educate Together. It's a primary school on the outskirts of Carlow town and has over 400 pupils. The school actually won a Nature Hero Award last year, which recognises excellence in education in nature. I met one of the teachers at the school, Claire Keohan, and she showed me one of their outdoor classrooms.
We want our teachers, I suppose, and our children outside, but unfortunately the weather in Ireland doesn't always match that. So what we've done here is created an outdoor classroom. So just a roofed structure, kind of you could call it a shed, I guess, a fancy shed, with seating and whiteboard and spaces just for the kids to come and learn in a different environment.
It's not just this outdoor classroom here, this fancy shed. You also have a geodome. There's also chickens that the kids look after. Can you tell me about some of the other things that you have?
Yeah, so like we mentioned, you have the chickens and the children just love, I suppose, just even walking past them, feeding them little scraps. Some of them get the responsibility of minding them, which is fantastic. They mightn't have a pet at home. And they really love that. They can't wait to get to fifth class and hope that they get on that team. And the responsibility of that is brilliant. Great learning and caring for something and the empathy for the animal as well. Kind of can be worked as a little mini business as well, so they can look at costings and selling the eggs maybe. Now often they just bring them home. Sometimes we cook with them. We also got a very fancy geodome. Not lots of schools aren't fortunate enough to have, but it's a fantastic space. It just makes everything better, even music, acoustically. Just a change up of scenery can make such a difference in the trees all around it. So even on the worst day, you can be out there and nice and cosy. We're out there recently in really bad frost, and the art that the frost was creating was just fabulous. So you can go out and just be inspired do lots of other things. We have an outdoor kitchen as well if you feel like cooking outside, barbecuing. Sometimes the odd time we do s'mores. So we just have lots of different areas that we've built on over the years.
The weather isn't always great here in Ireland, but you mentioned there the frost. So did the children be out regular? Did they be out in all weathers?
Listen, if it's a beautiful sunny day, everybody will be out. If it's not so beautiful and it's a grey, miserable day, some will be out. Some of us are, you know, more passionate than others about getting them out, or some of us just can because of smaller classes. But we do our best to get out and get them moving. I know when I'm in mainstream with a whole class, if they haven't gotten out at yard time, your afternoon is very long and the kids are very, you know, restless. So we'd always even try to get out, even just for a quick run across. If you dart through the rain, you get over here, you're sheltered. Even that 20-minute break in a different environment, do some art, do some music, do whatever it might be, a bit of circle time, anything, and back into the class. And then they've had that break and they're learning better then back in the class as well.
Claire Cohan there. By coincidence, Maura, my own kids were in one of the first outdoor classrooms a couple of years ago. I thought it was going to be a recipe for distraction with everybody looking at the clouds and the birds and the sheep in the field behind the school. But that novelty wore off very, very quickly, and normal classwork and education was just what it ended up being completely about. In this school, did the children seem to enjoy learning outdoors?
Well, unsurprisingly, Philip, they really enjoy it. Some of the pupils told me about the things that they learnt about, including what they learnt on a recent field trip to the River Barrow, which is a 10-minute walk from the school.
I'm Ira and my age is 10.
Ira, we're here in the polytunnel. What kind of things do you learn about when you're in here?
We learn lots of stuff. It's really just amazing. We learn how the plants grow, when they start to grow, and then we harvest them. And we've made ketchup and our own chips from the plants and fruit that grow in here. And it's just really amazing being out here. We do lessons. We have gardening clubs in here, and it is just absolutely amazing how fast everything grows.
Hi, I'm Isabella, and I'm 9 years old.
Isabella, you recently took a trip down to the River Barrow. Tell me about what you learned down there.
We learned about water safety, and if Claire fell in the water, she would have to lie on her back so we could try pull her out of the water. And then we learned about if the water was polluted or not. It was just the water's reflection. And we picked up some rubbish on the way with our litter pictures and with gloves, and we put them all in a trash bag.
And your teacher, Claire, didn't fall into the river. We should point that out.
Yeah, she didn't. It was just like an example.
Hi, I'm Cody. I'm 9 years old.
Cody, when you were down at the River Barrow, tell me what you learned about trees down there.
We learned about how they really gave us oxygen and O2. And it's just helps us live if you plant more trees.
So you learned how important they are to the environment. And what kind of trees did you learn about?
Birch trees and oak trees.
Do you prefer being outdoor learning or do you prefer being in the classroom?
Outdoor learning. Because you're able to do lots of stuff outside and play soccer on the grass and stuff. But in the classroom, you just sit down and do work.
My name's Creanne, I'm 11.
Kriya, what kind of things have you been doing when you've been out here in the outdoor classroom or, you know, in the polytunnel or with the chicken coop?
In the chickens, normally we'll help them and we'll clean them out. Some people, we do a little roster and we get their eggs then, and we're able to give them water and everything. And in the outdoor classroom and stuff, we do reading and we sometimes do our maths out there.
You also learn about planting and growing things as well.
Yeah. Lots of the time, we always, when I was in Claire's class, we used to always get little plants, and then we used to leave them in our classroom window, and then we would bring them out all here, and then we would plant them out here, and then we could see how much they grow.
What's the most interesting thing you've grown?
We grew pumpkins one year.
Oh, really? Yeah. For Halloween?
Yeah.
And were you able to carve them then?
Yeah, some of them. Some of them were quite small, but some of them we got to carve.
And tell me about the chickens. Do you have many chickens?
Yeah, we have a good few. I think we have eight or something.
And do they lay many eggs this time of year?
Yeah, a few of my friends, they got 7 eggs in one day the other day. And some of them, we have really mini chickens as well, and the eggs are teeny as well.
That's Kriya at Carlow Educate Together National School from Maura Fay's report on outdoor education on this morning's Today programme. Yasmin Seki's exit from Sunday's Dancing with the Stars seems to have left a lot of people seething, the sort of seethe you get when an injustice cries out to you to be corrected or avenged. Which is a grand way of drawing your attention to Philip O'Malley, talking to Joe Duffy on this afternoon's Liveline.
I feel that Yasmin Seki shouldn't have been voted off, and she shouldn't have been in the skate off, in the dance off with Aisha. And I think Kevin Dundon has done his performance and shouldn't really be in it.
Why not?
And I just think that something needs to be looked at the voting system format. Because Kevin Dundon is always seems to be at the bottom of the leaderboard and he seems to sail through. And the good performers are left battling on the dance-off. And it's not fair, really.
But it's entertainment.
Well, okay, you say it's entertainment, but...
But it is entertainment.
It's
not a general election.
No, it's not a general election, Joe, but it's a dance competition. And okay, I'm not an expert in dancing like Lorraine Barry and Brian Redmond and Karen Byrne and Arthur Gugliani, but at the end of the day, this is my opinion.
Yeah, that's fine.
And opinion across social media that Kevin Dundon is not doing what he should be doing.
And of all the iterations of Dancing with the Stars over the last few years, have you ever been prompted to phone before? You've been?
Yes. And I've been watching Dancing with the Stars since the very first episode. And I love it. I honestly love it because I'm a big fan of Lorraine Barry and Brian Redmond and, of course, of all the presenters, past and present. And I just think it's a great Sunday night viewing during the winter when we need it. And again...
And in a world at the moment where we probably need it
a little
break.
Yeah. And again... I respect Kevin Dundon. I follow him on social media. I watch his cookery shows on RT Today. I think he's a phenomenal asset to the country. I have no disrespect for him, but something has to give. And I was really shocked last night, really, really shocked last night. And I was actually in bits crying when Yasmin Seki and Simone Arena had to give up their dancing shoes, Joe. And I feel that the the voting format needs to be looked at somewhere or another.
We had someone coming on apparently, but they've not now coming on from RTE. The voting rules. Votes at home are counted and added to the judges' scores. The two couples with the lowest combined scores have to dance again. Then the judges decide who leaves the competition. The judges.
I just think...
Obviously one of the two.
Yeah, but I just think that the two of them are good performers week on, week off. Yeah, there may be, you know, some missteps in their performances, but Kevin Dundon, okay, maybe it's the entertainment factor. I don't know. I know the viewing public is a fickle bunch, but, you know, he's always in the bottom of the leaderboard week in, week out.
As voted by who? Who votes on the leader?
The viewing public.
Yeah, the viewing public, yeah.
Yeah. And I just think the voting format needs to be looked at.
Okay.
I just think, honestly, like, Yasmin Seki, she is one of the best, and I thought she really came on in leaps and bounds, and her performance last night really was phenomenal. And so was Aisha.
Okay.
And that's, yeah.
Stay with us, Philip. Jim Lawlers in Sligo. Jim, what do you think of what Philip is saying?
I would have to agree with him. I think there's the issue is that the public voting, first of all, the adjudicators made their decisions on the dancing, and Kevin Dunn ended up at the bottom of the charts. Then the public voted, and the adjudicators are left with a very difficult situation in that Kevin Dunn qualified to stay before the public had decided the bottom two. And therefore, the adjudicators were left with a quandary, a person who, in my opinion, definitely should not be in the competition at this stage now, was left in, and two people who are much more competent had to dance off and one had to leave. And I think there's a whole problem in the background, I think. It is possible, I believe, and I'm not saying this has happened, but it is possible that people can set up their computer to keep dialing a number. And when they're voting, you can get that kind of thing happening.
But you pay, don't you, every time you vote?
Of course. And that may well be part of the problem, in that the economics of the funds generated towards the cost...
We'd ask RTE then, is there a procedure where people cannot vote more than once?
That
Unfortunately,
can
we can't
that,
get a spokesperson from RTE. Even though they're only across the floor. Is there anyone over there from Dancing with the Stars winning the Come On Live line? Come on, lads.
An exasperated Joe Duffy talking to Jim, who agreed with Philip that Yasmin Seki's exit from Sunday's Dancing with the Stars was a sham of a travesty of a mockery of a sham of a travesty. In conversation on this afternoon's Live line. If it only seems like yesterday that DJ Annie Mac was on the radio talking to Oliver Callan, that's because it was, almost, only yesterday. The writer and DJ was in studio this time, with Oliver this morning, to talk about her most recent novel and to extol the joys of playing football.
The Mess We're In is my most recent one that came out. That came out last year in paperback. And that is kind of a lot about being Irish in England. It's about a young one who travels over to London and wants to get into music, and she lives with a rock band, and it's kind of a year in her life, kind of coming of age novel. Mm-hmm. And I'm in the process of writing number three. So I've kind of spent first half of this year, well, the whole first part of this year, whatever, it's 6 weeks or whatever it's been, just fully immersed in the first, in kind of getting the first draft into the second draft. So the first edit, trying to get the structure right, pull it into shape. So that's been it's kind of when you finish doing that, when you finish working on a draft, you kind of feel like a little mole coming out of the ground. Like I just feel like I haven't been in the world at all.
Rejoin society then.
Yeah, really like that. Because so that's what I've been doing over the last, well, for this half term, just trying to like get back into the world a bit. Yeah,
I was reading reviews of The Mess We're In over the weekend, and I mean, it just sounds like your life, young one. And it's the turn of the millennium, isn't it? It's 90s into the noughties.
Yeah.
And I mean, you lived with your brother who was in a band.
I did, yeah.
I don't know if you worked in a bar like the character.
No,
did.
No, I didn't.
And that's where the kind of homely stories come from. She's working in a bar and hearing Owlfellas in London.
Yeah, it's kind of I wanted to try and encapsulate what it's like for someone from my generation to leave Ireland, because it always felt like an underlying inevitability, you know, that everyone just left. That was what she did. That's what I did. And
still going on now.
Yes. And I never really thought about it at the time. You're just all starry-eyed. You're like, get me to London. I want to go and see what happens over there. And so for me, I didn't once look behind me. And, it, you know, at the end of the dedication of the book is kind of a thank you to my parents, because they helped facilitate my leaving like the south of Ireland when I did. And I never thought at the time what it must have been like for them. You know, got the youngest of four off to England. And I never thought about it at the time, you know, why I was leaving and under what kind of context I was leaving. And only 20 years later, when I kind of came out of the madness of being a DJ and a touring DJ and being on Radio 1 for all those years, did I actually think, what? I've got kids with English accents. What's happened? What's happened? What am I doing here? And I had this big kind of a couple of years post-COVID of thinking, should I move back? And, you know, being quite obsessed with that idea and looking at schools and all that.
And you had just left BBC Radio 1 around that time.
Yeah, just previously. Yeah, yeah. So I think there was also compounding that kind of confusion was the fact that I didn't have to be in London anymore. You know, I could work from anywhere. I was a writer. I was a podcaster. You could do those from anywhere. So I could actually have moved back. But then, you know, there's other people to consider. My husband is a music producer. He actually produces the Kneecaps albums.
Really?
Yeah, I heard you talking about them. So, he you know, he's busy in London. He's got a lot of work there. So it would have been a big ask for him.
But he's not a Londoner either.
No, he's a Yorkshireman.
So this is the neutral territory, is it, London?
Exactly. It is that, you know. It's very much neutral. But there's pros and cons with that. And I suppose the cons are that you don't have, you know, his family are in Yorkshire, my family are in Dublin and in Ireland. So we don't have close family. So you kind of have to make family. And part of the mess we're in that book was kind of me coming to terms with that and discovering my local Irish pub and the people in there and realising that they were kind of extensions of me in that way. We're all kind of people who've left Ireland and kind of live in the seams of the two countries and we're kind of misfits, you know, and I suppose feeling a sense of affinity towards those people.
That's a really interesting concept. Just you have to go find a new family when you're out of...
That's what happens. Yeah, that's what happens. You have to go and find friends that can act as family. And you have to kind of try and root yourself in the area. And I think what I'd done in England for so long is when you're Irish, you have this kind of sense of a safety net. You know, oh, I'll always go back to Ireland. You know, everyone's back there. I can always go back. And then I think my oldest son started secondary school this year or last year. And that was a real sense of like, oh, we're here now.
Yeah,
you know?
Yeah.
And I really
can't
have
uproot him now.
I can't uproot him and I have to root myself. Mm-hmm. Like my heart is in Ireland. I need to kind of try and make my heart in London as well a little bit, as well as my head. So that's what the football was about. And what the Irish pub was about is me trying to find a sense of community and a sense of, you know, some roots in London that I can call my own.
It sounds like it's an ongoing pursuit.
Yes. I don't think it ever ends. Yeah.
It doesn't end.
No. But the football was cool. Like I wanted to try and just get a sense of locality and also with that try and kind of get a sense of community as well. And there's nothing like a football team to give you a sense of community.
I find this extraordinary story, and I've read it's on Substack.
Yeah,
I
have a
whole story.
Yeah, I write essays on my personal life. Yes,
I mean, well, give us the idea. It comes from a very simple place, isn't it? It's 2022, and with your now English family, you're at home cheering on the Lionesses at the English women's football team.
Yeah, we're actually on the Flaggy Shore. We were on holidays in County Clare near the Burren, and the Euros was on. I was with my whole extended family and the Lionesses were playing and we were all rooting for England, which, as we know, is quite a rare thing.
Especially now it's in Clare. I'm hearing a whole different thing.
But I think because it was women and they were playing Germany and because... my kids are, you know, I call them half Irish, but they would, you know, they would probably call themselves English. They're born and raised in England, and my husband's English as well. So my family were rooting for England on behalf of them.
And it was a great story.
And it was such a good story. Yeah. And they won. And it was just so, it was so wild. I just remember watching it and feeling so emotional. And then having to question, why am I so emotional about this? And it made me kind of turn the mirror on myself. I used to play football all the way through my childhood. I was one of three girls who played, you know, you had the choice in primary school, Irish dancing or football. I always played football. I played for the boys' teams. And I kind of then went to Wesley College. There was no options for football there, so I played hockey. So I played team sports all the way through. Yeah. But then I went to college and discovered raving and sport. Sport
that was
got
but
choked.
You were good at football.
I was really into football. Yeah, I don't know if I was good. I must have been good because I got to play for the team.
Yeah.
So and I used to play down the green in my housing estate. Like all day, I'd go down there and play with the local fellas. So I just like it was like a natural thing that I liked to do. And then I kind of forgot about it. And then. Recently, after the Lionesses, I was like, why is it that I don't see women of my age in their 40s or even in their 30s playing football? When you see loads of fellas playing five-a-sides down
after social life.
Yeah. I started assistant coaching my kids' team because I got annoyed that all the coaches were fellas and all the women stood by the sides with the water bottles. And I was like, why? Again, there's this kind of sense of just a pattern here that the dads very kindly volunteer to coach and the women just kind of hold the coats, you know. So I started assistant coaching my kids' team and really enjoyed that, and then started playing myself. And it's honestly, Oliver, it's changed my life. It's changed my life. I thought that I would be too old to play competitive football. I play in a league with the women's team.
You're quite serious by the sounds of it, because you're on the team and it's every Sunday.
It's, yeah, well, we train twice a week and we play on Sundays. Our league matches are on Sundays and they take us all over London. It's kind of cool. You get to go to every corner of London, and it's all, you know, it's not, I'm one of three women on my team who are in their 40s, but most of them are in their 20s
really?
And 30s. Yeah.
Okay.
The very busy Annie Mack talking to Oliver Callan in studio this morning. Annie's Before Midnight DJ shows are in Galway and Dublin during St. Patrick's Festival next month. Regular visiting dermatologist Rosemary Coleman joined Philip Boucher-Hayes, sitting in for Claire Byrne this morning, to talk about the scourge of acne, a condition, well, we mostly consider confined to teenagers, but it turns out that that assumption, well, it's erroneous.
About 85% of teenagers are unfortunate enough to suffer, but people don't realise that 15 to 25% of adult women also get acne, and they probably form the largest group that dermatologists see in their clinics.
Do we have a good understanding of the causes, though?
Yes, we do indeed. Acne is around a long time. It's a common condition when oil glands get clogged with sebum, dead skin and bacteria. It shows inflammatory blackheads, lumps, bumps and cysts on the skin. And the causes range from genetic, if it runs in your family, you might be unlucky, hormonal imbalances, using the wrong skincare for your skin type, very heavy makeups or even overwashing, certain medications, stress can aggravate acne, and indeed things like physical pressure, like in the gym when people have barbells across their back, the weight of the back or the weight of the school bags on the shoulders. But a very big cause of acne, which I don't think gets enough publicity and which people can work on themselves at home, is foodstuffs that trigger acne. It's the old wives' tale of chocolate causing acne. It does. In certain individuals, Philip.
Oh,
and
okay.
They
all
can
right.
Make a big change to their food at home to help themselves.
Because I thought that we had kind of written that one off. Right, we'll get into that in a little bit more detail, but let's just discuss the spots first, if we can. Please walk away from the radio now, people, if you are in any way squeamish, because not all spots are the same. Talk to me through the different types.
Well, probably the three main types would be blackheads, which the youngsters will often start scrubbing, but these are not dirt. They're caused by oxidized sebum, so it is not dirt, and they can be quite uninflammatory, and some people will just get sheets of blackheads, but that is acne. Some people will just get a lot of white bumps under the skin, so-called macrocomedones or closed blackheads, again, a very stubborn type of acne. Other people will get lots of
So they're
of
white because they're not exposed to oxygen.
Exactly. Okay. And they're closed off and you can't squeeze them out. And then you can get the type papulopustular acne, which would be lots of small red lumps and bumps and little pus spots, little volcanoes. And then when they rupture into the skin, you get these nodulocystic lesions, big, sore, painful lumps. But there is one feature which is common to all of these types, and that is scarring. And this is why dermatologists are so passionate about treating acne as early as possible, because the vast majority of people can suffer a scar from even the mildest of acne. And the scars can be permanent and are extremely distressing and indeed cost money and can be uncomfortable to reduce.
OK, well, that then leads me to the big takeaway for anybody under the age of 18 listening to this now. Is there any circumstance ever in which anybody should take the law into their own hands in front of a mirror and squeeze a big zit?
I don't know why you reserve this for the under 18-year-olds.
Because that's when the habit starts. And that's when the temptation is probably at its greatest.
Well, may well be. I think it's anybody with a magnifying glass is the big problem. Yes, I do. I wouldn't expect somebody to walk out the door with a yellow spot and a big yellow pus bit on the top. I say get clean tissue, gently express it, wipe the pus off, dab it and don't pick at it. The problem is when they then pick the scab off that and pick the scab. But Philip, it's not picking that causes the scars per se.
It's not?
It may aggravate it. No, no, no. The scar is a primary feature of the acne and the bacteria which can dissolve and damage the skin, just like anything can scar the skin. Any cause of inflammation could potentially scar skin.
But having done that then, should you use some kind of an astringent to close the pore up again and stop it getting bacteria and dirt and whatever else in it?
Well, by all means, there are very nice over-the-counter products containing an ingredient called benzoyl peroxide, which is one of our oldest and longest standing treatments for acne. It's very inexpensive. It's extremely effective. It will be a very good thing to put on if you've squeezed a spot or have a few very active, juicy lesions that you want to settle down. The disadvantage is it bleaches your clothes, so you just have to be aware of that. You don't put on your favourite T-shirt afterwards. You might put it on going to bed at night with an old top, but it's safe in pregnancy. You can buy it over the counter. It's inexpensive and it's very, very effective, particularly for blackheads. The trouble is it's very irritating. So not many people can tolerate as much as they would need.
Obviously, there's a hormonal thing here at all ages in this condition. How often as a dermatologist do you find yourself referring people to GPs and getting them on the contraceptive pill as a way to treat their acne?
Well, they usually refer them to us and we will start the contraceptive pill when it's appropriate for that patient. So we would do that all the time for young girls. It's one step, particularly if there's any suggestion of irregular periods or other symptoms of hormonal imbalance, such as excess hair on the face, irregular periods, weight gain. But what we would do in that situation is investigate their hormones before we would put them on the pill, because once you put them on the pill, you are suppressing the hormones and you won't get a true picture. So what you're looking for there is often polycystic ovary syndrome, which is terribly common. And I'd particularly think of that, not when a young girl walks in the door to me with acne, but when the acne keeps coming back and I can't keep it away. If every time I clear it, it bounces back, then you start thinking of hormonal imbalances.
Finally, an explanation for my spotted visage, the mood swings and endless rewatching of Gilmore Girls. Dermatologist Rosemary Coleman there, talking acne with Philip Boucher-Hayes this morning. Katie Blackwood, historian in residence with Dublin City Council, is very, very interested in hair, as she explained to Brendan Courtney, who was sitting in for Ray Darcy this afternoon.
And you chose to go with the history of hair styles.
Yes.
To chart, I suppose, largely female history of the city. So why hair?
Okay, why hair? Well, it's okay. So I suppose hair styles are, you know, they're really interesting, I think. It's a bit like fashion, you know, they're like hairstyles follow fashion and it's connected to fashion, but then it's also part of our physical bodies as well, you know.
Yeah.
And like, obviously, you're born with whatever type of hair you have, your colour, your texture, that kind of thing, but you can change it.
You've pointed out something that's very obvious, but we don't think about it. And especially from my other job that I do is that they call me Brendan Hates the Hair Courtney. Every time I'm on a shoot, I'm really fussy with the hair. It's so intimate because it's connected to us. It's a piece of fashion that we wear and we sleep in and we can never take off. So it's really interesting.
Yeah.
And also, it is very intrinsically connected to trend, isn't it?
Oh, completely, completely. And like, I suppose that's what this, you know, this research that I'm doing now and this talk that I'm giving, it's about sort of like, what are the ideas that different hairstyles are saying, you know, because your hair and your clothes do, you know, mean things, like they're sending out signals.
Yeah.
So, I guess I was just interested in kind of looking at, you know, the sort of social and political things that are going on, and then seeing what kind of hairstyles people were wearing. And, you know, because sometimes hairstyles might be protesting against something. Sometimes they're conforming to whatever the norms are.
It's kind of like the adage in fashion, as economic times improve, skirt hem lengths go shorter.
Mm.
And as they get dour, the skirt lengths come down. This has got a very clunky version of it. But so how far back did you go? What's your starting point?
So I started at 1900.
Okay.
Yeah.
Good one.
Kind of the Edwardian period.
And lots of imagery.
Loads of imagery.
Yeah.
Yeah, loads of imagery. And like really interesting and, you know, quite like different to now. So like in the 1900s, the early 1900s, long hair was very much in fashion. So a lot of women would have had long, long, long hair, but they would have worn it up. So, you know, you'd have like there was a few different styles. So you'd have like there was one which was based, it would have been an international style. So it wouldn't have just been in Ireland, but it was called the Gibson Girl, which was based on this illustrator. He used to draw these pictures of these, you know, beautiful girls. But they were sort of this cloud hairstyle.
I'm thinking, like am I thinking upstairs, downstairs kind of? Sort of Victoriana.
It's like sort of puffed out with a bun then on top. And then you would have had, say, people that were, you know, very well-to-do, you know, might have had ladies' maids to do their hair, and they would have spent, you know, there would have been big, elaborate hairstyles. They might have been wearing shells or ribbons.
Are we talking Downton Abbey kind of thing?
Yeah, like I guess. Well, Downton Abbey goes up through the whole period, doesn't it?
Yeah.
But like big elaborate updos, but like they might have been plaited, but then people would have worn hair pieces as well. And there was these curly fringes were kind of quite fashionable for
them,
a while.
Yeah,
Queen Alexandra, she used to wear it apparently. So she was like the trendsetter of
the back time. Then, did your hairstyle very much state your class?
Your
wealth, say, for example.
Yeah, well, definitely if you had the time to spend on a hairstyle that, you know, most people wouldn't have had the time to spend on, and you needed other people to do it as well. You know, you would have needed other people to put bits in, and especially if you were wearing those hair pieces, which like they were like pastiches, sometimes they're called. So they would have been made from human hair.
Okay.
So you would have had to get them made.
So you'd have to basically be a bit wealthy then.
Yeah, yeah.
So what were the average, you know, working class women, what was their hair like?
I'd say it was a mix. I'd say it was probably like, you know, like you'd probably just have a lot of people who have their hair.
Yeah.
But then people would have put their hair up, because if they were working, doing something, you know, doing some sort of work, you'd need to have your hair out of your way. So up and in a bun was like the big
style. So I'm reading here, you were reading the Disembodiment, you were reading Emma DeBarry's book.
Oh, yeah.
Disobedient Bodies, brilliant book.
Yeah.
Brilliant. And that was a big inspiration to you. Tell me why.
Yeah, that was kind of what kicked off the whole thing. I just think she's really interesting. And she was talking about how, I suppose, you know, beauty practices and women's culture can often be sort of trivialised.
Very much so.
And, you know, things like fashion or hair or whatever it might be. It's like the idea is, and especially in history, which is kind of like a, you know, a worthy topic a lot of the time, that it's maybe not really that important. But I would argue, and like Emma DeBarry argues, that actually it's really intrinsic to, you know, who we are as human beings, the way we do our hair.
Actually, you're just triggering something I'm thinking while you're talking. So there's you can tell me if it's true or if it's fake. Mm-hmm. So history is largely written from a man's point of view.
That's what they say, yeah.
That's what they say, right?
Yeah.
So this is a new opportunity to tell history from a maybe a wider gendered point of view.
Yeah. I mean, there's an idea in history that it's, you know, the great deeds of great men. so it's, you know, people who would have had power and opportunity who tended to be men, you know, usually. And the working class history, say, or women's history, or, you know, other types of history maybe haven't had the same press.
So you've started back in Edwardian. Take me up now through, just gently gloss me over the broad decades of trends that come up. So we went and then the 20s with the bob.
Yeah, 20s. Love the 20s. 20s is great. So in the 20s, you've got the bob, which is a radical change. So suddenly everyone's cutting their hair short. And again, a very democratic hairstyle. Anybody can do that, as long as you can get to the hairdressers. And again,
on that, just before you move on, back then, nearly all hairdressers were men.
Yes.
That's really interesting. I didn't realise that. Tell me about that.
Yeah, so most hairdressers were men. So women didn't get their hair cut in public. Like, it was the type of thing that you that would happen at home in a private space. But there would have been barbers, say, who would have cut men's hair. And they would have had their own areas in the public. But then, you know, with the bob and like different hairstyles like that coming in, suddenly everyone needs to get their hair cut a lot more. So it makes sense to start cutting women's hair because they're coming in all the time to get their hair cut.
Dublin City Council historian in residence Katie Blackwood, tracing the history of the city through the lens of women's hairstyles over the years. Katie was talking to Brendan Courtney this afternoon. Finally, on this edition of Playback Daily, you might think that you or someone you know being summoned for jury duty would mean trying your best to get out of it, something that isn't always easy, apparently. But even for those that are prepared to do their civic duty, the whole experience can be, well, overwhelming. This morning, Oliver Callan spoke to writer and director Joe Ahern about serving on a jury in a murder trial in the Old Bailey in London 2 years ago. And just a warning, this excerpt goes into pretty graphic detail.
I think I assume I thought what most normal people think, which is it's a bit of a pain. Someone's got to do it, and I hope it's an interesting case. And I wish someone had told me at the time that that's perhaps not the most useful way to think about it, because if you're unlucky, you can get a case such as the one I was on, which was extremely harrowing. No one prepares you for the kind of stuff that you're going to have to look at and listen to over a prolonged period of time.
Did you have a reaction initially when you heard that this was going to be a murder trial?
Yeah, they don't tell you what the crime is until you arrive in court. I mean, again, I've worked on TV dramas that have kind of legal scenes and seen plenty of legal dramas. I'm sure a lot of people have. But I was surprised how little of the reality it gave you, certainly as a juror, because you're brought onto into the courtroom when the trial is already in progress. So it's a bit like walking onto a stage when you haven't been given your lines. You know,
nice.
You're summoned, you go to the jury box, and it's after you're sworn in, they tell you what the crime is. And all I can say is when I heard the word murder in court, it just sounds completely different. I mean, we throw around the word a lot. But when I heard the word murder, I just did not want to be there. I wanted to be anywhere else. But as I say, you can't really, there aren't really many excuses that would get you out of it.
No, and you obviously felt a sense of duty to go ahead as a juror. The case was absolutely horrendous.
Yes, it was. A gentleman was found dead in a cemetery park in London with wounds so severe they initially thought it was a shooting, but in fact it was a claw hammer. So you have to essentially look at several binders full of photographs and images of the wounds that were inflicted on that person. So it's very different from movie or television violence. You know, yes. It's not a 5 second close up. You can't look away. You can't walk out. You can't change channels. You've literally got to look at it for that length of time. So, you know, you're showing all these images where, you know, initially it's what was done to the face. They will then take the skin off and show what was done to the skull, then the skull off, show what was done to the brain. And so by the end of a couple of days of this stuff, it's really burnt into your mind and, you know, you will never forget it. I mean, those images are with me forever.
And because it's a trial and because they're going through so many witnesses, you're shown these images again and again.
Yeah, I mean, in my case, you're shown them 3 times. The prosecution takes you through them. Then at the summing up, the prosecution takes you through them again. And then at the very end, the judge's summing up takes you through them again. And I think in my case, because the defendant was pleading self-defence, I think the purpose of that was to say you can't do this to someone even in self-defence, you know, even if the other person started it, which wasn't the case, you're not allowed to do that to another human being.
The victim, he was a Sri Lankan man, Ranjith Kanka Malag, and he was a father of two. What effect did this have on you each day?
Well, one of the biggest problems is that one of the rules of being on the jury is you're not allowed to discuss the case.
Yes.
So you can't do what you would normally do if you've experienced something bad. You can't talk to your partner about it. You can't talk to your family. You can't even talk to other members of the jury unless all 12 of you are in a room in private, which doesn't happen until the end of the trial. So really, you're left alone with these images. You're not really able to process them because the way the trial works is the information is given to you in a way that suits the court of the case, not your curiosity. It's made very clear to you every day by the judge. If you go home and Google anything to do with this case, you'll break the law. And that's like, you know, it's up to 2 years in jail, a hefty fine, or both. Mm-hmm. So it's both very difficult to process what you're seeing and there's no way to unload. There's no emotional support. So, for example, you're told if you do feel distressed or upset by what you're experiencing, you can seek counselling through your GP, right, which is not really viable while you're on a jury case, or you could call the Samaritans. But if you do either of those things, I didn't, but I've heard from a juror who did, it's a very short conversation because you can't discuss it with them either. So you really are on your own until the thing's finished, and that's one of the big problems.
And it's very long. It's a 4 week long trial. So
mine was 4 weeks, but I mean I consider myself to have gotten off lightly because the case did not involve children. I've not suffered the kind of violence that the victim suffered, and it only lasted 4 weeks. Some trials last for months. So you have the stress of being taken out of your environment and your life for that period of time. And that in itself is traumatising for some people.
What about the people in your life then? Because obviously you go home and you can't talk about the details of the case at home or explain how you're feeling and why.
Well, that's the thing. I mean, you know, the case that I was on was very difficult for me, and I would have liked to be able to talk to my partner about it. And certainly a lot of my friends, when I discussed it with them afterwards, couldn't understand it and said, well, you know, why do you just break the law and, you know, talk to your husband? I mean, no one's going to find out. But I took the instructions seriously, and I understand that what the court says is that you have to receive every opinion and every fact, you know, through court. Even if you say you don't understand the legal term, it's also illegal to Google that at home. You have to write it on a piece of paper and give it to the judge, and everything has to be in open court.
Right.
So it's that isolation, I think, that compounds the distress of having to, you know, look at all these images.
You decided to speak to us here and to the Irish Examiner as well. What are you hoping to help change for jurors in the future?
Well, there are two things, really. One of the reasons why I'm talking about it is that I rather wish that I had a little bit more information going in so that I wasn't blindsided to the same extent. I mean, it really is like walking into a propeller. You have no idea.
Wow, that is quite the vivid image there. Writer and director Joe Ahern talking to Oliver Callan this morning about his experience of being part of a jury during a murder trial 2 years ago. And that's all I have for you on this Monday edition of Playback Daily. The programme was compiled, written and edited by me, Neil O'Shurathon. Don't forget you can listen back to all the programmes featured on Playback Daily on the RTE radio player. And the mothership, Playback, is on air and in podcast land every Saturday when Sinead Mooney has a bigger, stronger, faster look back at an entire week in radio. For me though, until the next time, thank you for listening and good luck.